people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my countrymen, they're walking on. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me, running down with life I'm fighting and falling down to me. If you don't love it, leave it, let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my countryman, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Well, lots more news and views for our people, and of course, those are the founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and all of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. Oh, this is Paul Fromm, and tonight I'm going to play the Ethno-State, which Ken Givenan and William Johnson and Karen Smith recorded earlier this week. This is a weekly show
Hello everyone, this is William Johnson, Chairman of the American Freedom Party, with another edition of the Ethno-State. Today we have truly an international conglomerate, a gathering of people to talk about the issues today. We've got Ken Givenan from Indiana. We've got Paul Fromm from Canada. We have Karen Smith from South Africa by way of Texas. And California, which is the fifth largest economy in the world, and I think Los Angeles probably within the top 10, that's where I'm from. So we've got a lot of perspectives here from a lot of different areas. However, Karen is sitting in a throne, so she really looks intimidated. And I don't know where she got that, but boy, I want one for myself. What is that?
It's my Starship Enterprise chair. It's a really, really, really comfortable computer chair.
Okay.
So those colors are great. They're very Halloween-y.
Yeah.
Look like you're in control, so don't wrest the show away from me. But in any event, let's start off with Karen. Tell us a little bit about about yourself and what you're doing.
Well, I'm from South Africa. I've been in the States 9 years now. And when I got here, I was very shocked to find that South Africa was totally off the map here. Nobody was talking about anything. happening in South Africa. So I started contacting show hosts and asking would they please speak about South Africa. And some very kind show hosts started doing regular shows on it, which I would get South African guests for because I never wanted to be the face of this movement. And I was dragged in kicking and screaming to do a show. And the rest is history. I now have two shows a week, which go out on five other networks. And a South African guest and a South African co-host. And we do our best to raise hell about what is going on in South Africa. I also raise money for the whites in the squatter camps in South Africa, and I help people who've come here, South Africans who've come here and applied for asylum.
Oh, very good. Well, you know, what we have going on right now is the World Series. And the reason why I know about that is the baseball teams between, I think, the Houston or Astros and the Washington, D.C. team. But Donald Trump appeared there a couple of days ago, and everybody was booing and all that kind of stuff. And that's what brought it to my attention that the World Series is going on. But my wife has been watching it a little bit, and she said the remarkable thing is that every team at this World Series has lost on the road. That's never happened before. It's always the away team that has won. And I said, what's so remarkable about that? And she says, well, crowd involvement is very important in any sporting events. And that got me thinking, you know, I didn't think that was the case, but I remember in the Los Angeles Olympics, we had this cute little South African runner by the name of Zola Budd. And you had this Mary Decker, who was just kind of an aggressive, mean American star. And everybody was rooting for Mary Decker in America, and they were cheering her on, and they started their big race, and Zola Budd, just a little 14-year-old wisp of a girl, she couldn't run from South Africa, but her mother was England, so she was English, so she was able to run on the English team. And so what happened, she was running barefoot, and she came in contact with Mary Decker, but Mary Decker, if you look at the tapes, she tripped Zola Budd, but Mary Decker fell out of the race, and everybody booed her. But good old Zola Budd kept running. She running, and I think she came in out of the medals, you know. And then they asked her later on. She says, "Well, I could have won, but I just didn't want to win because I didn't want to get up on the stand and take whatever medal it was and have everybody boo me. They hated me, and I just didn't want to do it." And that brought tears in my eyes. So I do know that from what my wife said, that's true. Team, the crowd cheering you on really means a lot. But I think Zola Budd was really a good example of the best that South Africa has to offer. And it's sad how even now we still beat up on white people from South Africa.
You know, Bill, I need to give you a follow-up on Zola Budd. She now lives in a squatter camp, a white squatter camp in South Africa. And about 2 years ago, she was getting married and obviously couldn't afford a wedding or a wedding dress or anything like that. So we raised money to give her a really nice wedding out of the squatter camp. And that's where she lives today, is in a white squatter camp in South Africa. The fact that she was an international track star does not matter. That is where she ended up. So just a little follow-up on that story. That is what her life is today.
Well, at some point in the future, we're going to take down the Rosa Parks statues, and we're going to put up a Zola Budd statue, because she really was a good example.
Absolutely.
However,
I visited some of those squatter camps in South Africa, and it's absolutely heartbreaking to see the poverty the whites live in, and much of it's a result of the fact that many working class and middle class whites are denied the employment opportunity because there's vicious pro-black discrimination in hiring policies and enforced by the government.
Yeah, and white people around the world don't care. We still are beating up on South Africa.
Yeah.
Just about a month ago, Robert O'Brien replaced Bolton as the national security advisor. And he's really done an outstanding job. He helped negotiate a ceasefire in between the Turks and the and whatever for the against the Turks with the Kurds, and then with this recent attack and destruction of the Al Qaeda, ISIS, or whatever person in charge or whatever. But however, I Googled him to see what I could come up on Robert O'Brien. And this is what it came up to be. It said, Donald Trump's new national security advisor attended a segregated university in South Africa, described as one former vice chancellor as routinely racist. He attended the University of the Orange Free State under the South African apartheid system. And it goes on and just saying, trying to paint him as being a racist because he attended that University of Oregon Orange Free State, and that's where he met his wife. And they're still beating up on him and everything. So what do you know about this University of Orange Free State?
It's one of the ones, let's put it that way, it's one of the major good universities in South Africa where they poured out incredible students that were in great demand all over the world. There were lawyers and doctors and surgeons, and they all came out of that university in huge demand all over the world because we had one of the best education systems in the world. And we didn't just teach, like in America, they teach American stuff. If it doesn't happen here, it doesn't happen. In South Africa, we got a full-on history, geography, everything of all the countries of the world. We an international knowledge. We had a really good education system. But yeah, today the education system, 30% is a pass mark. And you can do your
life. I'm sorry, 30% is what?
A pass mark. You graduate with 30% marks in South Africa.
Oh, a pass mark.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right, I got it. All right.
Yeah. So, and they're bringing that down now to even less than that. So, and of course, everything is a quota system. So to get into university, you can have gotten the best graduation marks or what you would call here SATs. You could have gotten the best score in the country, but if you're white, you still won't get into a university. A black person who has a 30% pass mark will be given that place instead of you.
So if you need surgery, you could be operated on by a doctor who got a 30 pass mark.
Yes.
That's horrific.
Or even better, somebody who never studied medicine at all, never mind 30%. They recently arrested a doctor in South Africa, a black doctor, who'd been practicing for something like 15 years. He had no medical experience whatsoever, no credentials whatsoever. And yet he'd been hired by the hospital and been doctoring in the hospital for 15 years.
Right, however, we've got to look at the other side of that. I mean, there are some benefits of South African medicine that we don't have here in America or in Canada. I mean, we cannot use albino parts as medicine. So, it's a give or take. You've got to balance things out.
Great, and you also can't get a doctor's note booking you off work for a week because your blood is too hot.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that you can do in South Africa.
Yeah. So it's give and take in all societies. We just have to take the good with the bad.
This is rather personal because a very good friend of mine whom Karen knows passed away in April of this year in South Africa. And when I... Over the last couple of years, I've heard a lot about her various medical miseries. And this was a relatively young woman, she's 45. And seeing her from an outsider, I've got to say, her treatment was absolutely botched. She being in the poorest county of the United States, I'm sure she'd have been alive today. It's pathetic. And that's a white person. Affording the best medicine that they can, but if the local practitioner that doesn't even have a medical training, I mean, it might as well go to William Johnson.
Right. I can draft a great force majeure clause, and I can operate on your goiter.
Hey, lizard man.
Okay. I like that samurai sword in the background.
That's right. Well, okay. Keeping in line with the international topic of today's discussion, let's go on to the various topics that we have today. So, Ken, what's the first article that we're going to talk about? It's from Italy.
Most people are familiar with a public figure in Italy by the name of Salvini, if I pronounce that correctly. Matteo Salvini, is that how you pronounce his name? I think it is.
Yeah.
He was the interior minister in Italy, and he was known for his stand as a patriot. He was very much bothered by the invasion of Italy by third worlders, and he actually did something about it. He would prohibit their boats from docking in Italian ports. Well, he effectively got fired. I don't understand how the parliamentarian process works. They managed to get him out. All right, turns out that they have elections in Italy, or just had elections in Italy. There is one region called Umbria, which is basically dead center in the country. And this is an area that has been in the control of the far left for 5 decades. And guess what? His political party, or the alliance that his party leads, won that election. And so that's a major, major step forward for the so-called conservatives.
So tell me about this Salvini guy. Is he a Trump? Is he a Paul Fromm? Is he neither? What do you guys know about this guy?
Oh, we'll let Paul Fromm take that.
Well, Salvini, I think, is the real deal. He regularly denounces the globalists and denounces some of the people behind the immigration invasion, like George Soros. I mean, he's pretty informed. He's an extremely dynamic person. He's a great campaigner, and it was some of the jiggery pokery of Italian politics. That he was the vice president. Oh, right. I didn't say a bad word.
I'm going to have to use that term. I've not heard it before. What is jiggery pokery? I'm going to put that in my dialogue.
Flim-flam.
What? Flim-flam?
Flim-flam.
I'm writing that word down. Okay, go on.
He was sidelined, but he did such a good job as vice premier in charge of the interior or immigration. He made a difference. The invasion ships stopped landing. And he said, international outfits that go out and patrol the Libyan coast and start picking up the illegals and shipping them to Italy, you're not going to be landing here. He stood by it, even though they dramatized a few things. Here's a shipload of blacks waving their hands and they're the wretched of the earth. And he said, not here. You're going. So they went off to Spain, which is ruled by traitors, and they got the land there. But Salvini made it stick. He's ferociously popular. And I could see in the next general election, he could perhaps go all the way. He's a dynamic, incredibly likable person, and I would say he's pretty close to the real deal. You know.
Okay. Well, you know, we have over in Australia, you have like New South Wales, and you have New York, and New Amsterdam, and New England, where the when they come to this country. They are in the New World. They take on names and they add new to it. Well, I had never heard of the word Umbria before, but I do know of Northumbria. So Northumbria is in England, right? You guys, you familiar with that?
Yes.
So does that mean that the Spaniards originally moved up to England and then they named Northumbria after the place where they came from? I that might be. Trying to tax your history a little bit too much.
I never stretch.
Oh, is it? Well, what?
No,
where?
Northumbria is a very old Viking area in the north of England. I don't. The name I think has some other root. It's not. It's Times of Life, but I don't think it's named after the area in Central Italy.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, that was a. I'm just trying to show my knowledge of geography a little bit. But okay, very good. Then so basically, is Italy overall going to be leading the charge now, kind of like what Hungary is doing for our Western civilization, or is there too much drag by the establishment in that country?
I can see as long as they've got leaders like Salvini, they can make a real difference. You know, the response in Britain and the United States and Canada is, well, there isn't anything we can do. Even with Donald Trump, the invasion hasn't completely stopped. Salvini has made it stick, and he's incredibly popular. He represents what the vast majority of Italians want. They don't want Italy to stop being Italy, and they've seen towns where they're overwhelmed with Africans doing, you know, unspeakable things like roasting animals at, you know, public place and molesting the local girls and so on. And they just don't want it. And for a long time, the same type of establishment that we have in North America and much of Europe that are basically collaborators, so they want the invasion and they enable it. Or they wash their hands and say, well, there's nothing we can do, you know, human rights, or the UN says, or somebody else says. Salvini said, he didn't care what anybody else said, it'd be Italy for the Italians. You know, and boy, that resonates.
My concern is that his life could be in danger. I mean, seriously.
Oh, you could be. Absolutely.
Particularly if the mafia is involved in trafficking people into Italy. If he is hurting their cash flow, they'll take this guy out. And they've done it before, they'll do it again.
Well, here's a funny story. In Sicily, there were so many illegals, from Nigeria, that they actually took over a lot of street crime in places like Palermo, and they were even putting a beating on the local mafia. They were so
yeah, rich. That's what I think. I think the mafia doesn't want the competition, so they probably support Salvini, try to get, because these immigrants from Africa or from Jamaica or from, you know, Cuba, they'll put the mafioso to shame with their violence. If you get a Jamaican gang and an Italian mafia get up against each other, boy, I'm going to put my money on the Jamaican gang.
Yeah. A few years ago when I was in Seattle, I was told by a good friend of mine, Dr. James Sanchez, that a lot of your really bad characters from Los Angeles, your Negroes, the various street gangs, were moving up north because they were having their clocks cleaned by the Central Americans, who are more ruthless, but they're organized, and that may go back to genetic material, but they were a bit more organized than the blacks, and they're just walking all over.
Well, yeah, I mean, they have a history of cutting out people's hearts and holding up to the sun god. You know, if that's what your history is, if I were a black blood or a crip, I'd be heading for Seattle, too.
The most liberal city in the U.S., except for Portland.
Yeah.
Bill, in South Africa, there's a place in the Cape called the Cape Flats, which is ruled by drug gangs, by coloureds. Now, a coloured in South Africa is not an adult. It's an interbred person, what you call mulattoes here. Yeah? And they rule the Cape Flats with great violence. Anyway, the powers that should not be in South Africa decided to send in the army to create some peace in the Cape Flats. And within a week, the army had to retreat because the gangs just beat the hell out of them. They're more organized, better armed, better trained, better everything, and the army had to retreat. So it was, and this was this year. So it's a very bad state of affairs for the South African government, but it also shows you that the gangs and mafia type people are far better organized than any government group.
Yeah. Well, we see, I think, maybe we're entering into an era of great protest. And maybe what Salvini is doing on a democratic approach kind of falls along the lines of what we're seeing among mass movements in other countries. I mean, you have a major uprising in Hong Kong, major uprising in Chile, And then I think in Lebanon too, didn't they have just like a million people show up? So we might be embarking on an era of massive uprising. If you can't do it on the ballot box, then you may do it through organized efforts of groups of people. I don't know. You're on mute, Karen, and so.
I definitely think so, because the masses are rising up. And if you take the example of South Africa, and I really do not approve of what the blacks are doing there, but everything they do in huge numbers and take to the streets and loot and burn and kill and necklace people. But they get attention because the squeaky wheel gets the oil. So the people, the same as Antifa here, they make more noise than anybody else. And they get the attention, they get the press, they get the TV. Their posters are seen, whereas anyone who's protesting against their protests gets very little attention from the press whatsoever. So I really do think that mass protests, they work. But one doesn't need to go to the extremes of the Ferguson, where you burn down half the Ferguson, or what's going on in South Africa, where you burn down the whole country, including universities, schools, hospitals, municipal buildings. I don't think one needs to go to that extreme. But if you fill the streets with people, I think people have to pay attention. Somebody has to pay attention to it.
Well, Paul, I admire your insight on world affairs. Do you see that these uprising in these countries and the efforts that of our nationalists trying to move forward, does this presage something bigger?
Yes, I think that there's, for various reasons in each of these countries, tremendous discontent with the political establishment that tends to be unresponsive. And I think that helps account for the protests in Hong Kong. It's blind fear on the part of many of the people, especially the younger people, facing the increasing repression in China. And to the extent that China wants to more and more tear up the agreement by which Hong Kong was given back to China, I think it was sort of one country, two systems, and the younger people are very afraid. In China, they now have a program called social credit. Now, that's not to be confused with the economic system of social credit. And you get certain like points for being a conformist and doing good things, as the party might see it. But you get negative points for instance, going to a protest or doing politically incorrect things. And depending on your rating, you might not be allowed to get on a domestic flight. You've never committed a crime, but you've got a low rating, and you could be denied a flight, you could be denied employment, and so on. And I think that's a lot of what's motivating into a Japanese train just today, and it really is quite something. They've been in the streets at least once a week, going back to June. Now that's pretty impressive.
Who's they?
The protesters in Hong Kong.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You might say it broadly speaking, the more of a pro-democracy.
Right.
People. And then you know what they're now doing? They're burning the red Chinese flag. You know, I mean, that's pretty strong stuff.
Yeah, that's going to get a bullet in their family. Why haven't we seen this unrest in America? I mean, you have Donald Trump will go to rallies and they'll have a bunch of people show up, but then he attends a World Series system and he gets big boos and they say, lock him up. Why is there not a solid protest effort in the United States?
I think it is because conservatives tend to be reservatives. There's something about people who have a patriotic conservative mindset that they're not easily triggered. And beside that, we have had generations now of media telling us how we are supposed to react. And, every conversation is transformed into a conversation about race. And they use race as something to beat us with. You know, they decide, first of all, that the most evil thing in existence is racism. It's worse than murder. It's worse than child molestation. It's worse than rape. Worst thing is racism. Then they take that and they attach it to every individual, every ideology they don't like. The reason they do that is because it's effective. It really works. And I think that's why, because we're scared to death. Same thing in Great Britain, by the way. They can human traffic little British girls. And nobody will say anything because they're terrified of being called a name.
Yeah. I think that's
one thing. The other thing is many of our supporters aren't conservatives, which means that they're used to being well-behaved. The idea of lettering up a placard and taking to the streets, well, it probably doesn't, I don't want to generalize, probably doesn't bother any of the four of us. Many conservatives, it would be like showing up in church in a bathing suit. You don't do it. That's just not in their genes, unfortunately. Whereas many of the more leftist people, take to the streets at the drop of a hat.
Well, I think what Ken says about how they've used words to such an effect that we are cowed from even speaking out. The word racism comes to mind. It makes me think that maybe we should start using some words to that effect ourselves. Now, like, if, for example, I was to say, well, I'm opposed to race mixing. I don't like race mixers. Other people say, what does it matter? Let them do what they want. And so I think that word doesn't have any power that it had during the 1950s. But if you said something like, I'm opposed to white genociders, that is a more powerful word. You're a white genocider for race mixing, or for supporting that, or for supporting the destruction of the white race in Western civilization. So if we kind of take a word and turn it towards our advantage, and that's just one example, I don't like white genociders, then maybe that'll catch on and it'll have, because you can say, I'll let whoever wants to get married marry whom they want. But you can't say, well, I guess a lot of people are doing it now, but you can't say, I support the genocide of the white race. You know, that's something that is, among a decent society, unassailable. Of course, under much of society, it's de rigueur.
But do you mind if I quickly read through a list of language-loading terms that the far left has used against us?
Please do.
Okay, here are some of them that I've run across, and I actually keep a tally of these. Okay, these are in alphabetical order. African American, blackface, brought into the 21st century, which is a euphemism for globalism. Chauvinism, critical race theory, cultural appropriation, disadvantaged, disenfranchised, dog whistle, equity, false consciousness, feminist, first people, gay, gender fluid, gender neutral, hate group, hate speech, homophobe, implicit bias, indigenous people, internalized patriarchy, intersectional or intersectionality, intolerance, Inuit, which is a word for, because you can't say can't say Eskimo anymore, Islamophobe, Latinx, liberal, they're not liberals, they're authoritarians, but they hijacked the word, mansplaining, marginalized, microaggression, misogyny, Native American, neo-Confederate, neo-Nazi, non-binary, objectified, patriarchy, people of color, poverty-shaming, progressive, racist, rape culture, red face, red skin, social justice or injustice, stereotype, systemic racism, transgender, Uncle Tom, undocumented immigrant, vexed class dynamics, white privilege, white supremacist, woke, and xenophobe. And those are the ones I've stumbled across.
Okay, I don't understand. Well, that's a definite. What are those words used for? What do you mean? What are those words?
These are terms that are used by the far left to channel our thinking.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Either to confuse, like undocumented alien. That's an illegal. But the words are a little fuzzy, or to abuse us, like a most of those words were abusive, like racist, xenophobic, etc. I think we labor under both a virtue and a curse. Our virtue is that we want to be rational. We want to be reasonable. But that's also a curse because our enemies are entirely emotional. The terms they use are, and I think we have got to start doing that too. We face this big problem with the Antifa or anti-racism. It's got the street level, the types who want to beat you up or hit you with a 2x4, but the higher level types who want to restrict you, deplatform you, and so on. And I think we should use emotional responses to that. Anti-racism, I'm not even going to debate what racism is. Anti-racism is anti-white, it's anti-free speech, and it's anti-democratic. You know, we throw it back on them. They're the haters. In fact, we had it's an incident that makes you want to giggle. We've got a very aggressive Jew in Canada named Ezra Lamb. He's a Zionist, but he has an internet media outlet called Rebel Media, and they do a lot of good work. I've known Ezra since his university days. He really is pro-free speech, well, 90% of the way. And he's done some great work on exposing immigration and other things. Well, anyway, Ezra was launching a book called The Libranos, you know, like The Sopranos, but it's called The Liberals. The Libranos, last week, and a Legion. And that created a huge controversy because the Legion has a policy of not affiliating with hate groups. Now, here is a Zionist, a journalist, and he's a hater. Now, nobody ever explains how he's a hater. The main commander of the Legion denounced what has happened, and it makes you cry. What do these soldiers, what did the veterans think they were fighting for in the Second World War? And my parents thought they were somehow fighting for freedom. You know, the famous song by Vera Lynn, "We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, we'll meet again when the world is free." In a general way, I think that's what they were fighting for. And I wonder, what is this collection of whacked out old alcoholics doing? There's nothing connect. That's why I think the response has to be a tough one, an emotional one. And I'm pretty sure Ezra Levant's going to give as good as he got. But when you decide that a Zionist discussing the Liberal Party of Canada is a hate group, I mean, the boys don't have any meaning anymore.
Is that the group that Faith Goldie was a part of?
Yeah, she was part of Rebel Media until she became too much for Ezra. But Faith
is a racist.
Much more the real deal. I'll give him his due. He doesn't like me, incidentally. But I don't know why. Must be my hairstyle. But he's a pretty aggressive journalist, and they've done some good things. And one of his journalists who looks like old enough only to be in high school, took on that miserable, wicked little thing from Sweden. And he pursued her down a hall when she was in Edmonton, Alberta, and she wouldn't say anything. She without her teleprompter, I don't think Greta could even tell you her shoe size. So that does some good work, and yet when they're labeled as a hate group, the term doesn't have any meaning. We're not in a rational world, and that's why I think we might want to rethink our tactics. Rather than say trying to debate racism or whatever that might be, throw it back emotionally. You're the hater. You're anti-white. And white which they are.
What would happen if we started calling the Southern Poverty Law Center a hate group? Would we risk being sued?
I don't know American law well enough. Well, William does.
I don't think so, but I think that they would probably feel compelled to list themselves as a hate group. So maybe we should send them that email and say, we expect the next time to read the list, see them on the top. That'll be my responsibility. I'll get them on their own list. Okay, in any event, let's move on. I want to talk about the next topic, and it's an intriguing title, but I'm not sure what the article is all about. It's something about a Klansman who's black. Ken, can you tell us about that story?
Yes, this is in the state of Kentucky. There is an individual who is a black man by the name of Daniel Cameron, who has been portrayed as hanging on to the Klan tail, not the coat tail, but the Klan robe of Donald Trump. So here you go again. They can't argue anything logistically. They have to reduce everything to racism. So we've got this cartoon, the guy's a cartoonist. His name is Joel Peck. And he drew this cartoon, folks at home can see it on the screen. And in the cartoon, there is an image of Donald Trump. He's actually a Klansman. It just says Donald Trump on his Klan's robe. And tailing behind with his hand on the robe is this black guy by the name of Daniel Cameron. Now, the thing that is interesting about this story is the cartoonist is white. So you have a white leftist. Notice I didn't say liberal. That's one of those terms they use against us. They're not liberals, they're authoritarians. But you got this white leftist who is attacking a black man for being a part of the Ku Klux Klan effectively. They don't see their own hypocrisy, but there's a couple things we get out of the story. And that's one of them. Leftists are hypocrites. They don't see their own racism. The other thing we get out of this story is what we've mentioned a couple times, and that is they have to keep transitioning every discussion to a racism because they can't deal with the logic. They can't deal with reason. They've got to demonize it, and that's the best way to do it. The reason they do that is because it's effective. But very quickly, Daniel Cameron, and he is a candidate for and probably will be Attorney General in Kentucky, and he responded on Twitter. He says, this is what Herald Leader, that's the newspaper, quote, tolerant, unquote, left-leaning newspaper thinks about black folks who dare to be Republican. You're a racist following the Ku Klux Klan unless you hate Donald Trump. Let's make history on November 5th and show we don't take orders from the elites anymore.
Well, that's interesting. The first thing that comes to mind is that for much of my life, and certainly a couple of generations before I was born, the number one slander that a black man could level against another black man was to call him Uncle Tom, which was a takeoff of, Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin. But I have not heard that phrase lately, maybe in the last 10 years or so. But it seems to me that Donald Trump, the supporters of Donald Trump are, black supporters, are called a lot of names other than Uncle Tom's, but it's the same concept. I'm wondering if we're ever going to get to a situation where the Camerons of this world are going to be praised for supporting our president, or are they still going to be ostracized? This is a situation of where he was criticized and ridiculed by a white cartoonist and a left-leaning white-owned newspaper. I'm wondering what the local black Kentucky voters think of this Mr. Cameron.
Well, you know, there is a poll that was published by The Hill, which is not a conservative website by any stretch of the imagination. But their poll revealed that 41 to 42% of middle-aged black men, we're talking 35 to 60, support Donald Trump. I mean, that's almost half. That is unheard of. Now, the flip side of that is 93% of black women say they'll vote for anybody but Trump. They don't care who's on the ballot. If it's not Donald Trump, they're going to vote for that person. So it's kind of balanced. So it's still at 85% black support for Donald Trump. But that's really encouraging when you have over 40% of middle-aged black men, ages 35 to, what did I say, 60, their minds have changed.
Right, but over 80% of middle-aged black men have a criminal record and they can't vote at all. So I think we're not going to get too far on that. But in any event, see, this comes to mind why there was booing at the Washington baseball game, the World Series against Donald Trump. And I think it might partially be attributed to the fact that the people that can afford to go to these baseball games are the wealthy D.C.ers, and they're the ones that are part of the swamp that Donald Trump is trying to drain. So maybe if we could build a coalition of white people and black men who can vote, maybe we'd overcome the rest of the country and we'd get them reelected.
It's interesting that the term Uncle Tom is probably too obscure for many people today. So you have to say something so blatantly inflammatory that he's... So because he's pro-Trump, and because, according to the cartoonist, Trump is the Klan, if he's pro-Trump, he's a black follower of the Klan, which is, I mean, we're in the world of complete blithering nonsense.
Yeah, well, I guess the question is, are there a number of black people that support the Klan? And there are. Because, see, the Klan, it has a persona far beyond what it actually was. I mean, they didn't do all the bad stuff that the media or the history books claimed they did. And in fact, I think I've probably told this story before, but I used to tour the country before the internet took place with a black nationalist. He was a back to Africa black man. His name was Robert Brock. And he was very supportive of what the Klan did. And I didn't realize, because he thought it was a pro-white group, and if you can have a pro-black group, you should be able to have a pro-right group. And he says, I like the Klan a lot better than any other white group, because you know where they're coming from, you know where they stand, and they're honest. And I didn't know how far he took his feelings until one time, I heard about it, I was not there, but he appeared at Pastor Pete Peters' retreat one time, and Pete Peters is a pastor that operates a Identity Christian group somewhere, I think, in Colorado. But they had a guest Klansman come out and give a speech. And so this Klansman come out in this full regalia with a full hood. He didn't say a word. And the reason why he didn't say a word, because it was Robert Brock, as soon as he opened his mouth, he tells a black man. He was up there on stage. And he wouldn't say a word. They asked questions. He couldn't say anything. Then they whipped off his cape and his hat, and they saw that it was a black man. They just all hooted and howled like that. But Robert Brock's position was that the media and the historical perception of the Klan is drastically different than what it was. So yeah, there are black people who support the concept of whites grouping together to support their interests. And the most extreme example, I guess, is the Ku Klux Klan.
Well, let me ask you this question, Bill, or whoever wants to answer. We haven't heard much from Karen, by the way. But my question is, why does everyone just believe the Klan was an evil organization? Now, in Indiana, it was. I mean, they weren't racist, but they were a mob. So they were involved in criminal activity. But they were, this reputation the Klan has does not align with reality. But why do we all believe it? Any idea?
Well, why do you say that the Indiana Klan was involved in criminal activity? I'd never heard that before.
Well, because the head of the Ku Klux Klan, who, by the way, just coincidentally actually grew up like three blocks from his house in Indianapolis, but he was into influence peddling. If you wanted something passed in the Indiana legislature, you would pay D.C. Stevenson.
He was probably the governor. I think the head of the Klan of that state, they were so powerful, he probably was the mayor of Indianapolis and then the governor of the state.
Well, he was the de facto governor of the state. I mean, he ran Indiana, and he was ultimately convicted of homicide.
Oh, okay. Well, then I guess he was kind of a bad guy.
Yeah, he was a bad guy. He took advantage of the Klan. He was charismatic. He was a salesman. He was first a socialist, then he was a Democrat, then he became a Republican Klansman. He was an opportunist, probably. Well, he was just a criminal, you know. He saw the opportunity and he took it, but it had nothing to do with racism.
But see, you read about Donald Trump's father being arrested at a Klan rally, so you know. you've got, I'm surprised that they don't make more of that every day in the Trump presidency. But that came out early on when he was running for office. Okay. In any event, let's move on to the next topic. The next topic, I guess it's some sort of sad affair of a three-year-old found dead in a dumpster. What's that all about?
A little girl, 3 years old, was discovered in a dumpster.
Let me stop you just now. Since this is more of a feminine touch, I would like Karen, you to listen to this and be the first one to respond.
The story is that a three-year-old Camille Cupcake McKinney was found dead in a Birmingham, Alabama dumpster, charged with capital murder on Patrick Devone Stallworth, 39, and his girlfriend, Derek Arisha Brown, who was 29. She died from asphyxiation by suffocation. They found this little girl in a dumpster. Now, when I was writing this story, one of the thoughts that came to my mind is this is probably not the first time this girl's been abused. This has been basically her life, and if she hadn't died, this is how she would have been treated until she left home. But they did kill her, and they did find her in a dumpster, and what a sad commentary for the black community. Good, Karen?
But I really think that's all of a piece with the abortion up to birth. Because where does it end? If you can abort a baby after it's been born and just leave it to die, where's the age cutoff for that? So does it mean that if you don't like your child when it's three, you can abort it? Or you don't like them when they become teenagers and start acting up, can you then abort them? And then you look at the opposite end of that spectrum, with Obamacare wanting you to go and off yourself as soon as you turned 50, because it was your civic duty to do that, and to demand that you go to end-of-life counseling from the age of 50. It's all of a piece with what is happening in the world today. Life and children mean very little. So you don't like your kid, okay, you kill them and put them in a dumpster. It's the lack of value of a human being. And whether that goes back to video games or violent movies or whatever, I'm not sure, because there's all sorts of things that can be blamed for it. But again, it is the liberal view that children don't have a value. And being pregnant and having babies, it also doesn't have a value. So if you carry that forward, why should it matter that you killed a three-year-old? It's still a baby. And
well,
you got rid of it.
This is my thought on it. And when Ken says that, well, it's a poor reflection on the black community, but what comes to my mind immediately is there was recently a very pretty blonde cheerleader who had a baby and she didn't want to raise it, so she killed it. Of course, she got off because she claimed that it was stillborn, or she, you know, she got maybe charged with dealing with a corpse. But then you also had recently a couple of days ago, I read about the 25th anniversary prison anniversary of a woman by the name of Susan Smith, who killed her two children because the guy that she was dating didn't like children. So you have a lot of people in our society that are having that same callous attitude towards children. But my views have kind of evolved or devolved, I guess, in that I'm really taking a eugenic approach. Whereas in today's society, the conservatives really say, oh, the sanctity of life, you've got to be, we've got to preserve even the life of the unborn. And I'm thinking, if we did not have the abortion rate that we have now, there would be so many blacks born into this world that it would just be overwhelming our country. And so I think that we really need to take a eugenic approach, and non-Christian countries such as China had taken whatever means necessary to get a handle on their population. So I can see that I no longer support the views that I held for the first 60 years of my life, that the unborn child is inviolate and you cannot, you know, and you must let the child be born and put it up for adoption. But the flip side of that, if I were to come up and say, yeah, I agree with you, left-wingers, I think we should abort these babies too, because we need to have fewer non-whites born into the world, that they would jump on the other side and they would become immediate lineup with the Christians. So I don't know how to approach this issue. All I know is that I got to keep it away from my wife, or she'll get mad at me.
Well, there are several legal ways to kill black people, and one of them is through abortion. So abortionists are the ultimate racist, white supremacist, white racist.
Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern time. The show is repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. All of those are Eastern Standard Time. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me, here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, would the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here may it wave our boast, our pride, and joined in love together, the thistle, shamrock, rose, and twine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. At Queenston Heights and Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes, and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield them never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever.
Maple leaf forever. God save.